from KQED. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim. Coming up on Forum, testimony continues today in a gender discrimination lawsuit against the venture capital firm behind Google, Amazon, and other top tech companies. We get the latest on the trial that's putting a spotlight on the gender imbalance in Silicon Valley. Then at 9:30, proposed bans on tobacco at all baseball venues in San Francisco and statewide could make that familiar image of players with wads of chewing tobacco in their cheeks a thing of the past. But there's some pushback. That's all up next on Forum after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim. A San Francisco jury is hearing arguments in a gender discrimination lawsuit that's gripping the tech industry and beyond. Ellen Pao alleges her former employer, venture capital firm Kleiner Perkins Caulfield and Byers, passed her over for promotions and retaliated against her when she ended an affair with a married colleague. Kleiner Perkins blames Pao's poor performance for her failure to advance. The trial is offering a rare glimpse at gender politics in the tech world, and joining us to discuss the implications of the case are Melinda Reichert, a partner at Morgan Lewis, where she specializes in employment law. Thanks for joining us in studio today, Melinda Reichert.
Good to be here.
And we're also joined by Nellie Bowles. She's a contributing writer for Recode, a tech news and analysis site. Hi, Nellie Bowles.
Hi. Thank you for having me on.
Well, thanks for being here. And Nellie Bowles, I want to start with you because you've been covering this trial daily since it started on Tuesday, and you've described it as ferocious. I mean, already we've heard about unwanted advances from partners in bathrobes, women excluded from ski trips and power dinners. Can you walk us through the key particulars and also tell us what's the latest?
Yeah, well, I mean, it is ferocious. It's a very intense feeling in the courtroom. The first day, the room was absolutely packed. So really what we're seeing are a lot of internal emails that I don't think anyone thought would get out or starting to get out. And what you mentioned with the all-male ski trip, there's one email chain in which a Kleiner Perkins partner organized a Kleiner Perkins ski trip, and an entrepreneur emailed him asking if he could bring some female entrepreneurs, one of whom was a founder of Rent the Runway, which is a $500 million company now. And the Kleiner Perkins partner said, no, let's punt on the gals for now and find two awesome guys who can come instead. And this was a corporate ski trip. These were entrepreneurs from Kleiner Perkins invested companies. And he was explicitly writing that he didn't want to bring women on the trip. And then, really egregious stories are coming out. There's another story that happened the other day where one Kleiner Perkins partner lured a female partner to New York under the auspices of meeting with a very important internet executive. And they get there. The internet executive doesn't show up. The two partners have dinner. And then that night, he tries to push himself into her hotel room, which, you know, they're bad actors in every industry. A law firm might have a similar situation. But the really disturbing part of that was then, and she described this while she was on a stand, and really quite astonishing take on it. And the really disturbing part is then she went back to her seniors at Kleiner Perkins and said that she doesn't want this man on her review board that year because he was supposed to write her annual review. And they denied that request. And so she actually was reviewed that year by this man who had just sort of lured her and attempted to impose himself on her.
And I understand that even yesterday there was new testimony that Ellen Pao's, the man that she broke off the affair with, also contributed to her review but wasn't listed as a contributor?
He contributed, like whether or not it was secret or whether he was left off because he wasn't a senior partner, he was not listed as a contributor. And so what we saw yesterday is her evaluation in 2011, which was no doubt used to help fire her in 2012, her evaluation started extremely positively. The first bullet point was congratulations on RPX, which was her investment that went public within 3 years, which is remarkable for any startup. And so it said congratulations on RPX. And then the next draft that bullet point was gone, and it focused more on criticism. And then all of a sudden, a third draft appears. And in the third draft, it focuses almost entirely on criticism and includes a new sentence saying, we think you should seek employment elsewhere.
So Nellie Bowles,
so the question is what happened in between, and it looks like one of her harassers, actually two men, the one who had the all-male ski trip and one of the men who she had a consensual relationship with, but then had a bad falling out with, they contributed to the report.
And so the things that you bring up is an example of why this trial is resonating, because people feel like it's shining a spotlight on what's been described as rampant sexism in Silicon Valley. I mean, when you talk about this, you sound surprised or sort of you talk about these as sort of shocking revelations, but you do cover the tech industry for Recode.
Yeah.
Were you aware of such things happening, or
absolutely.
Is it more just
two things that are really shocking about this? First is that this isn't a secretary suing a boss. This is Ellen Pao, the CEO of Reddit, an enormously influential company. These are two Silicon Valley titans coming up against each other. These are two incredibly powerful groups. Ellen Pao is a very influential internet entrepreneur now. So that's what makes it really a sort of fascinating trial. And then the other thing is that I cover these issues a lot, and often women won't want their names used. They'll talk about instances where VCs harass them. They'll talk about instances where they don't feel comfortable in the room, but they won't want their name attached to the story. And I understand it, but here, Ellen Pao, who doesn't seem like a firebrand when you meet her. She's not like a flag waving. She doesn't seem that political. Here's Ellen Pao, who is willing to go to court, is willing to sit in a courthouse and put her name on the line and put her career on the line to fight for this. And that's fascinating to me. And that is really interesting and very unique. This is historic. It's absolutely historic.
We're talking with Nellie Bowles, a contributing writer for Recode, a tech news and analysis site. And we're also talking with Melinda Reichert, a partner at Morgan Lewis, where she specializes in employment law. And Melinda Reichert, most of these kinds of cases settle, right, to avoid exposing these kinds of details. Why didn't this case settle?
Well, I have no personal knowledge or information about the background of the case. I know only what I've read in the press, and then I was also at the opening statements on Tuesday. But typically, there are a couple of reasons why cases don't settle. One is that one or other, or even both of the parties, are very principled, and they want to have their day in court, particularly a case like this where there was a lot of publicity early on, and each side likely wanted to have his and its day in court to get the full story out. And then the other reason that typically cases don't settle is that people have very different views on the value of the case. And one party thinks that it's worth a lot more than the other party is, and they simply can't reach agreement.
This is a half-hour segment, so I'd like to give out the number now. Give us a call with your questions or comments on this trial. We're at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. You can also email us at forum@kqed.org, or you can post your comments or questions on our website at kqed.org/forum. And what is the likelihood, Melinda Reichert, that this case could settle during the trial?
Well, I've tried a lot of cases, and I've never had one settle during trial. They often settle on the eve of trial if they're going to settle. Obviously, they can settle at any time, but presumably both parties are pretty knowledgeable about what the evidence is going to be. That's what discovery is all about. And so when you come into trial, there shouldn't be any surprises. And therefore, if both sides have correctly evaluated the case, I would not expect them to change their positions during the trial.
And these gender discrimination cases that do make it to trial, how often does the person who is alleging the discrimination win?
I haven't looked at the statistics recently, and I certainly haven't looked at them in specifically on gender discrimination. It really depends on the court, the case. So I don't think there's any way that you can say, all right, the plaintiff generally wins or the defense generally wins. It's so specific to the case. And then sometimes winning is not is getting less or more than you expected. So sometimes somebody might want a lot of money and they might get some money, but not as much. Did they win? They didn't get as much as they wanted, but but they got something. So there's different definitions of what winning means.
Well, based on what Pau is alleging, do you think she has a strong case for gender discrimination?
It's hard to say. I haven't heard all the evidence yet, and obviously the jury will have to hear all the evidence and make the decision. So all I've heard is the opening statements, and it's really hard to tell. I think that, you know, there were some weaknesses in her case that came out clearly during the opening, but we'll
Such
have to
as?
Find out. Well, for example, little things like, first of all, this is not a sex harassment case. And the judge made that clear in his instructions. And yet so much of the testimony seems to be about sex harassment rather than gender discrimination. And then there was the fact that she asked for, quote, a $10 million or I think it was eight-figure, which is $10 million or more severance package. And often when you have a bad fact, and I think that's a bad fact, that's a lot of money, the plaintiff has to bring that out in the opening or else the defense will bring it out. So I thought that was not a good fact for her. The fact that a lot of the men are not successful at the firm, the fact very few people are successful, I thought that was a bad fact. And most of all, that Kleiner Perkins, of all the venture capital firms, it seems that Kleiner Perkins has a pretty good reputation and based on a study that was mentioned in the opening, in fact, is the number one rated firm for women in the venture capital field.
Right. Yeah. Studies have found. Sorry, go ahead. Nellie Bowles?
All of these things are totally true. And actually, John Doerr, who's one of the sort of founding members of the firm, or one of the most important members of the firm, he actually comes out looking really good in the whole, in the trial. He comes out looking like a major supporter of women, consistently supporting Pau. And so it may, they're going to have to argue that a few bad actors sort of created a culture, even while Kleiner Perkins as a whole has been making huge efforts to recruit women.
Right. My understanding is that studies show that female leadership, just 6% of partners at VC firms are women, which is actually a decline from 2010, though at Kleiner Perkins, it's about 20% of their partners are women. So they're actually above the average, quite above the average.
But they're not in the managing partner role. So when you make the really big money in venture capital is when you become a managing partner, and there are very few of them, but, you know, a few dozen or something like that through the years, and there wasn't a single woman managing partner until, I think, 2011, 2012, with Mary Meeker. But so there are a lot of women at Kleiner Perkins, but the idea is she wasn't promoted to the senior ranks because of her gender is what she's alleging.
Right. I understand that Kleiner Perkins CFO testified that money can quintuple once you become a managing member of the firm.
There's a lot of money at stake. And her salary was not insignificant. I mean, as a junior partner, you can make $200,000 to $400,000 a year. But when you become a managing partner, you start to get carried interest. You start to get sort of a real chunk of the companies that you invest in, and then you can make $2 million a year very easily.
Speaking of money, Melinda Reichert, the defense seems to be also pushing a narrative that Pau's motive is actually money. Can you talk a little bit about that?
I often say that there are lots of reasons that people file lawsuits. They're angry, it's revenge, but sometimes it is money. I don't know her. I don't know what her motivations are. But again, that fact that she asked for an eight-figure severance would be a very large and very unusual amount to ask for.
What about the $16 million in damages that she's asking for now? Is that a very large sum?
Very, very large sum. It's going to be very interesting because you have to predict, and the experts will testify about what she would have earned if she'd stayed at Kleiner Perkins versus what she will earn from Reddit. And then it's the difference is the amount of her damages. So she has mitigated her damages by getting another job and a very good job. And so the jury will have to decide, if it finds in her favor, how much less she would be earning at Reddit than she would have earned if she'd stayed at Kleiner Perkins. And of course, the statistics are that very few people progress to the highest ranks at a venture capital firm. So she would have to show to the jury that she would have progressed to the highest ranks and made the big bucks, as they say.
Yes. And, you know, this case, as I mentioned earlier, is actually being viewed as almost a referendum on gender practices in Silicon Valley. And I wonder, given the particulars of the case, which are clearly complicated and messy, has been used to describe it as well, do you think this is a good case for that?
I'm astounded at how this has become such a media frenzy. I don't think it is at all representative of what goes on in the Silicon Valley. The venture capital field is a tiny, tiny part of the Silicon Valley. And of course, it has very few employees, and these are very small partnerships. Obviously, these are big name people. Alan Powell is a very big name person, as is Kleiner Perkins. But I don't in any way think that this is representative of the Silicon Valley.
But in a New York Times piece, Emily Bazelon noted that venture capitalists as the kingmakers who can decide what startups survive, that they actually have a lot of power in making the industry more receptive to women. Nellie Bowles?
Venture capitalists may be a small group, but they have enormous outsized influence. I mean, they set the tone. They choose the companies. They host many of the events. Their influence in the Valley is really, really large. And so it does matter, and the minutiae of what's going on here does matter, and it does ripple out.
Nellie Bowles, despite the particulars of the case, do you think that if Ellen Powell loses, that the perception could be that gender equity problems in Silicon Valley have been exaggerated, given the importance that's been placed on it related to...
No. I think whether or not she gets, $16 million... At this point, I mean, it's relevant to her, and of course it's relevant, but at this point it's less relevant because of everything that's already coming out and the discussion that's already started. So even if Kleiner Perkins wins, technically, they still have started this enormous discussion, and then they still have to address the fact that there are all these emails that came out and all these problems with their social events and their culture.
A loss could have a chilling effect, for example, on women fighting back?
I think so, but not really. I don't think that women would feel like massively chastened by this. I think that having someone stand up and fight is enough of a boon to women in Silicon Valley that I don't know. I mean, maybe it would. I don't know. I think we'll just have to see. On that one.
David writes, I've worked with Ellen in the past, and she's super smart, principled, and tenacious. If she feels like she was legitimately wronged, she will not give up. This is a test of wills. Do you get that sense, Nellie Bowles?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think, yes. I think there's a lot of pride involved on both sides. And I think she's very determined, and she's an interesting character to be the firebrand here. Like the very first day of court, there were three photographers stationed outside, including one of our own, Rika, and all three of them missed Ellen as she walked in because she's so demure almost. She kind of walked in on her own without a big posse and just sat there on her own. Her sister sits behind her in the court, and I think she seems very determined and kind of quietly resolute would be how I would describe her.
And Melinda Reichert, you were saying that this may not be the best case for a referendum on gender equity in Silicon Valley. How would you want, if for some reason Ellen Powell does not get what she wants in this case, how would you want that to be perceived?
I think this is just a one-off case. I think that the tech industry generally is very, very focused on gender issues. I think that there are a lot of difficulties in getting, for example, women engineers. And I think that the tech clients that I'm familiar with are very, very focused on trying to improve their statistics and their numbers. But personally, I think this problem starts way early in junior high school and high school with women dropping out of the math and science classes. So I don't think this case is as big a deal as it's been made out to be. I think it's one case based on one set of facts, on one small group of people in the Silicon Valley, and that the issues in the tech industry will continue whichever side wins and loses.
And let's go to Deborah in San Jose. Hi, Deborah.
Hi. My comment, I disagree with the woman who was just talking, because I think that this case has to do with a very small community of employers in Silicon Valley. The public companies, by virtue of the fact that they're public, have to disclose their demographics, and they are trying to diversify in terms of gender equality for some of the STEM positions and leadership. But then you have an enormous community of businesses, the consulting partnership, come to mind where they're just that. They're partnerships. They're not public, and their leadership is filled with men, probably white men, but I can't say that for sure, but it is filled with men. And for a woman to reach the ranks of partnership in those levels is much, much more difficult, if not impossible. And so this case with Ellen Powell, I think, shines the light on an enormous community that's out there who believe that they're insular to these issues.
Deborah, thanks. This case is offering a rare glimpse into the inner workings of a major VC firm that is certainly not disputable. Melinda Reichert, correct?
For sure.
And let's go to Lee in San Francisco. Hi, Lee.
Hi, good morning. I just wanted to point out something that really struck me. Early on, Nellie Bowles made the comment that this wasn't just some secretary. It's a powerful player, and the plaintiff, that is Ellen Powell. And, you know, I don't want to criticize her for that comment. I just think it's revelatory of a cultural assumption we make that informs our judgment when it comes to people taking up these sorts of gender bias and sex discrimination cases. Why don't we look at Ellen Powell with the same lens? Maybe she has an axe to grind. Perhaps she is, you know, out for a pound of flesh and trying to exploit the situation for her own gain. Is that possible? Or is when someone, a woman, you know, cries foul, is she always to be given the benefit of the doubt? Because she is, in this case, a quote, you know, a powerful, educated, rich person.
Well, Lee, thanks for the point. Nellie Bowles, did you want to just respond
quickly? I think it's a really good point. And I think it's totally, totally spot on. What I meant is that this case is fascinating because it's these two Silicon Valley titans, but it's no more or less legitimate than any other gender discrimination case. And I think you make a great point. Her power and her wealth has nothing to do with whether or not she's more correct or more worthy of winning.
Bob writes, what happened to Powell is disgraceful and all too prevalent in what is supposed to be a forward-thinking, progressive, egalitarian environment. But women in Silicon Valley VC firms, coding circles, and law firms know that it's a boys' club. Another related issue is the extent of the privilege afforded to all of the folks in this club. Powell is living a dream that so few will ever realize. They have hit the lottery. Her package with Reddit and potential compensation at future cash-rich tech companies will never be reached by thousands who toil in the industry. Nellie Bowles, do you have a reaction to Bob's comment?
I don't totally follow. Can you?
Well, I think what Bob is saying is that what happened to her is disgraceful. At the same time, though, she is also somebody with tremendous privilege as a result of where she is right now. So it's a very sort of interesting, I think, contradiction, or not contradiction so much, but a sort of an interesting sharing of two realities.
Yeah, I think
in the tech world.
She's both wildly powerful, and in this situation, she's positing herself as subjugated and as a victim. And so we have to just think, can someone be both powerful and subjugated? And I think a lot of the case hinges on that.
Well, Nellie Bowles, thanks so much for joining us. She's a contributing writer for Recode, a tech news and analysis site. And we were also joined by Melinda Reichert. She's a partner at Morgan Lewis, where she specializes in employment law and in defending employers in these types of cases. Thank you both for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for having us.
I'm Mina Kim. Do stay with us.